Welcome, everybody, to Juwanza for Life. My name is Juwanza. The show is also known as Health, Wealth, and Divine, because that's what we talk about. We're going to talk about either your health, your divinity, or your wealth. Well, tonight, we've got a special show tonight. They're all really special, but I tell you, every time I have an opportunity to interview the guest that I'm going to be speaking with tonight, it's extra special, and you all get a really, really special treat. And we're going to be telling you about a workshop that's coming up, and after I introduce my guest, I'm going to tell you about the workshop in the beginning of the show and as well as at the end of the show. I don't know why you wouldn't listen all the way through the end, but sometimes people have to go and do whatever, so I want to make sure that you do not miss this information. Again, this is going to be a very powerful workshop, and we don't want you to miss it. My special guest today, though, is Orwa. That's Dr. Orwa Hehimedirun Comet. He's Paramount King, actually, of the Washington, D.C. region of the Osiriset Society. And Orwa has been a member of the Osiriset Society since 1975. He was appointed Orwa, which is Paramount King, by Shechem Meshechem, Dr. Rahu Nefer Amen I, who is the chief priest and king of the Osiriset Society. Well, as Orwa, he is responsible for guiding the lives of Osiriset's members and the Society's activities in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. He's also a member of the Society's Carry Head Priesthood and headed the Osiriset's African Support Project. He holds a master's degree in African American Studies and a master's degree in education, both from Howard University. He's also a doctor. He's recently gotten his doctorate degree, and I just want to say congratulations again on that. He's also author of two fabulous books, author of African Names, The Ancient Egyptian Keys to Unlocking Your Power and Destiny, as well as Divine Kingship of Asante, a model for sustainable development of self and community. Again, that's Divine Kingship of Asante, a model for sustainable development of self and community. Speaking of which, that is what the workshop is going to be about, and we'll tell you all about that. But first, let me welcome my guest, Dr. Nkame. Welcome back to Health, Wealth, and Divine. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for being my guest again today.
That's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting us back on.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I know you're a very busy man, and to fit us in is truly, truly humbling. And I, again, thank you so much. I'm glad to be able to share with the listeners about the workshop that's going to be coming up on Saturday. That's this Saturday, March the 10th. It's going to be titled after the book, The Divine Kingship of Asante, a Model for Sustainable Development of Self and Community. And for everybody, make sure you write this information down. That's going to be this Saturday on March the 10th, starting at 10:30. That's going to be from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 a.m., and that's going to be at the Thurgood Marshall Center at 1816 12th Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., and you can register online at www.appeal, that's A-P-P, like Paul, EALincorporated.org. Again, if you want to register online, that's www.appealincorporated.org. And for more information, you can call either 202-630-2507, or you can call 800-711-7851. Again, that's 800-711-7851. And just so that you're aware, the workshop is free to all first-time workshop attendees. Again, for all first-time workshop attendees, it's free, and it's also free to appeal members. Otherwise, it's $10. Okay, so just wanted to make you aware of that. I'll tell you about that a bit more. We'll discuss that a bit more as the show goes on, but just wanted to make sure that in case you had to leave, you got that. Okay, Dr. Nkame, again, welcome back. It's always a pleasure. Just to be able to discuss a topic like the Divine Kingship of Asante, and even as we titled this show, Reality versus Fiction, the Divine African Kingship in Review. As people are aware, there's been a movie that's come out, has become very, very popular now, called Black Panther. And in the movie, I actually did get a chance to see the movie, Orwa, There's a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of information. But again, there's reality and then there's fiction. Would you like to make any correlations between, with you having written a book on the divine kingship of Asante? Obviously, your thesis was on that. You know a lot of information, have written a lot of information. How was the movie in your eyes?
Well, it's good in terms of exposing people to Africa and African people. I mean, it's good from that perspective. But again, it's fiction. So we have to recognize and realize that, you know, even though they did a good job of researching and presenting the material about Africa, they tried to be pretty solid with the cultural references, et cetera. But again, it's fiction. So there's going to be things in the movie that are going to be not accurate. There's going to be things in the movie that will portray well. So the most important thing, though, is that it exposes, again, once again, to the concept and the idea of the divine kingship, the African kingship. Because our people we've often said, you know, from the 60s on, that we're descendants of kings and queens. And that's a valid point. But the point is, if that's the case, why are we in the situation we're in today? And why are we banking and resting and hanging hats on that particular point? Meaning that, what does it mean to be a king or a queen in traditional Africa? What's the purpose of a king or a queen? What does it mean to be a divine king or queen? And not only that, what is the idea that we have in terms of restructuring? When do we become other than African in this country? And what did we lose when we gave up that title of being African? There's a lot there to unpack. So let's begin with some of it. You know, I like to reference the question first is, when do we stop becoming African? And we all know, those of us who are from the 60s and 70s saw the movie Roots when it came out, the miniseries. And there was a very poignant part of that movie where the African Kunta Kinte refused to accept the white man's name. Right? He refused to accept the white man's name. He got beat, and ultimately, eventually, he gave up and accepted the white man's name, Toby. Well, that represents, to my mind, and to the minds of those who see it that way, that represents the transitional point from being an African to a Negro. Once we gave up our African concept, our African names, our African perspective, African hold on to our African traditions, then we became a product of this society here. Sure, we still have the DNA in our blood, our system, et cetera, but in terms of the cultural references, the ideas that we promote, the ideas that we accept, the way we go about doing things, we've given up so much of the African past and accepted the white man's version of what he wants us to be, which is the Negro or the nigger, whatever term you prefer. So that being the case, then what is it that we truly lost? When Kunta Kinte gave us his name, he just didn't lose his name. He lost his culture. What's embedded in African culture that would have us distinct or change us or transform us from the caricatures of Africans that we are today into truly Africans? And this is a very important point because not only is it affecting us over here, but it's affecting Africans on the continent as well. So they've gone through the same time decolonization process that we went through here. So that many of them are for giving up their African traditions and values, culture, accepting the Western model. Because everybody believes that the Western model has something value and benefit. So let's expose this point. Black Panther was a futuristic movie, right?
Yes.
Now, the premise of the movie is, for those who have not seen it, that there's a kingdom in Africa that's hidden from view. The principles, the values, the culture is hidden from view. And that the value of the kingdom rests in not exposing it to the dominant society, to the outside world, so to speak. they have their own traditions. But one of the traditions that is kind of is based more on the Western model of what the future looks like than what an African, traditional African model might look like, is the tradition of how the king is selected. We want to highlight this one point because this point goes to the very heart of what we're trying to talk about here.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, there's this ritual combat that the king, or the, those who will vie to be king, go through in order to determine who shall be the leader of the people. I'm not saying that that doesn't happen, that hasn't happened someplace in Africa. I don't know. Probably, possibly, it's possible. But the idea that the future leader is to be chosen based on power and might is a very Western model, very Western ideal, in that the West doesn't have as the foundation of its culture the idea that there's something of character that must be presented, must be honed, must be cultivated within a person who was going to lead the people. And we go back to the model that we're talking about, the Asante model, and that of Cameron as well. We find that the real value of the kingship, the divine kingship, is that the person who sits on the stool, the person who assumes the title, has to be the representative of God within the people, to the people. Not only that, God has to be reflected within that person's character. So the idea of a divine king is not someone who has autocratic control over the people. That's coming from the European model of kingship, which is based on the divine right of kings, where the king can do anything he wants just because God supposedly is the one to put him there. In the African context, the king rules on behalf of the ancestors and the people. So that the people put him there and the people can remove him. So he doesn't have a divine right, carte blanche ability to do whatever he wants anytime he wants. He has to be answered. He's answerable to the people. And the only person that is put in that position, the people that are put in that position, are people whom the society deems as being quality of character people. Meaning, it's not about how strong they are. It's not about how much might they can wield. It's about what kind of character do they have. What kind of person do they have? What kind of person are they? Are they a type of person who's going to try to take advantage of others who might? Are they a type of person who's going to try to take advantage of others because they have wealth or whatever? Or are they the kind of person who's going to be humble, who's going to be receptive, and look out for the interests of everybody, be they the lowest in the community or the highest in the community? Everyone has an opportunity and the right to communicate with and to the king about their issues through the council that rules, that guides the king. So within the traditional context, for example, within Asante, you have the Asante Ruling Council. Well, everyone in the community, everyone in the Asante community has a representative on that council. Even strangers, there's a position, a chief position, who sits on the council who represents anyone who's not even a citizen of the area. So everyone has someone that their position can be taken, their rights can be taken and discussed, their needs and what can be taken and discussed within the council of the king. So it's a truly democratic system, which is not based on popularity, but based on character and quality.
Everybody, my special guest is Dr. Orwa Hehimedirun Kemet. He's Paramount King of the Washington, D.C. region of the Osiriset Society. I see you on the line, callers. If you have a question, just press 1 and I can bring you on board. By the way, if you are listening by phone, please put the phone on speaker. Okay, do not sit there with the phone to the side of your head. Please put the phone on speaker. All right, thank you. Can we talk about the oracles just for a moment? Because I did not see in the movie a reference to the oracles as it pertained to making the selection of the king or the next person in succession. As you mentioned, it came down to a matter of who was the strongest, who could fight the best, or whatever. Could you make reference to the oracles and how they are used and consulted when, in reality, we're talking about the difference or reality versus fiction, in reality, the oracles are used. Can you talk about that and how that relates to the choosing of the successor or the next king?
Well, different cultures have different processes. Some of them have priests and priestesses who are trained in the art of spiritual communication, who will give counsel and guidance to those who are in rulership positions relative to the kinds of moves that they should make or not make. And other traditions have divination systems in place where they do the same kind of thing, where they consult, go to God through the divination system to get guidance and counsel in terms of what and how the king should move or what the people should do in relationship to certain things, which is the point I'm trying to make here, which is the point about the whole thing. If we're talking about a divine kingship, again, divine represents the supreme being, and divine king means this person is here as an emissary of the supreme being. And for that perspective, we have to look at, well, what's the spiritual value or spiritual practice or spiritual foundation upon which the kingship rests, because that's what it means to be a divine king. You rest upon some spiritual tools, some spiritual principles, some spiritual value. And that's what's missing from the concept within the movie, because the idea of divinity is not really presented there in the movie as terms of guiding the people. There's more might versus, and then right and wrong and that kind of thing. But it's not really that kind of information. We're looking for the spiritual leader, so to speak, of the people themselves, or to be the spiritual leader of the people, which is what the divine king becomes.
So it appeared that the fight in the movie that, you know, ultimately led to, I don't remember the characters' names or whatever, but it seemed like there were a fight between, they were related some kind of way. You know, they had a common ancestor, father, or an uncle, or somebody. But just for the listeners to have the reality concerning how the stool is, the golden stool, is passed on, or the legacy, or the kingship, shall I say, is passed on. Does it stay in the family? Is it a situation that stays in the family? Because I'm trying to, because there may be people out there that may have seen the movie, but and might draw their conclusion concerning African divine kingship from the movie. Okay, but just so that we can give them the real, how it really works in reality. Does the stool stay in the family, or no?
Well, yes. And there's different systems, different cultures have different processes, some are matrilineal, some are patrilineal. Now, in the movie, they refer to the queen as the queen mother, which would imply that it was a matrilineal stool. But the way in which it went down, you wouldn't know if it was matrilineal or patrilineal because of the relationship between the two protagonists. Now, the issue is this, though. They would let it boil down to a ritual combat to determine who's a challenge, because anyone can come up and just challenge the held leader.
Mm-hmm.
But that could never happen within a traditional system, because the stool, in most instances, stool is, unless the king does something which is a violation of the spiritual principles of the community, which he commits some kind of taboo or whatever, unless he commits some egregious fault which would require him to be removed from the stool, stools are held for life for most people. As a matter of fact, within Asante, for example, and many other cultures, and unless a person dies on the stool, they're not even counted within the record of stool holders. For example, I'll give you a classic example. Everybody's heard of Ya Asante was the first. She was a woman, the queen mother of Ijesu, who led the Asante rebellion against the British in 1900. The British had to come in and demanded that the Asante give up the golden stool. The Asante refused to do it. So they exiled the king, and then they kept pressing the Asante, and the Asante was challenged. And then she said, look, if y'all are not going to fight, we'll fight. So she organized the women to start the rebellion against the British. Now, the goal, the object of the war, just for the sake of discussion, The objective of the war was the golden stool. The British demanded the golden stool, and the assignment gave them a fake stool that the British got all the way back to London before they realized it was fake. Literally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the British end up vanquishing or defeating the Asante militarily in that war. But they never captured the golden stool. They never got the golden stool. And that was the objective of the war, and they could never really say that the British won the war, even though they won the military conflict. But the point is this. When I was doing my research and I interviewed Yasanto II, who's a descendant of Yasanto I. She would be like the great-great daughter of Yasanto I.
Okay.
And she's the queen of Ijesu. Now, in Ijesu, there are three, I'm going to make sure I got it right. See, there's two or three different families that the stool rotates through. Now, they have a common ancestress some hundreds of years ago, but there's three different families, descendants of that common ancestress, from whom the stools rotate. Now, she was, and her family is a direct line to Yasanto I. So every time the stool becomes vacant and it's her family's turn to put a woman on the stool, they name that person in succession of Yasanto. So she's called Yasanto II. So this is over 100 years. I said, ask her, well, how come it's so long a period between you and Yasanto I? It's like 100 years that there's been, Queen Mother been living that long. And she said, no, what really happened was her grandmother had been Yasanto II. And but back in the 50s and 60s, there was this internal strife in Ghana. As Ghana was moving toward political independence from the British, there's an internal strife between the political interests of Nkrumah and his people, and the Asante had another objective in terms of independence. This internal strife led to the kinds of challenges that people faced, where actually people lost their lives battling over these positions. And unfortunately, even today in Ghana, some of this foolishness still takes place, where people are arguing over these political parties, which come from Europe. The idea comes from Europe. People are being killed and maimed, whatever, behind some European system that hasn't served the people well at all. But that's a sidebar I'm going to go there. Anyway.
Okay.
Your grandmother was Yasanto II. But because of the political strife that was taking place, she ends up having to flee Ijesu for her life. And when the things died down, when Kwame Nkrumah was eventually assassinated by the CIA, the military eventually took over, and then things kind of died down on that front. Then she came back. But because of her experience with all this back and forth with, threatened for her life because of the political party and stuff, she decided, I'm not going to, this ain't worth it. I give up the stool. So she's not counted in the hierarchy of history of the stool holders of Ijesu. So that's why Yasanto II, now the current Yasanto II, is called Yasanto II, and that Yasanto III. So the point being that it's family held. Stools are family held. A family can be what we would call extended family, where you might have a common grandmother, a great-great-great-great-grandmother, and then you have descendants from that great-grandmother, that great-great-great-great-grandmother. And each of those families has a right to that stool. But who gets the stool is some kind of system that's worked out between the different families in terms of the rotation. Oftentimes they rotate. This time you get it. Next time another person gets it. Next time we get another person get it. For example, the Asante Hene, the stool that rules the Asante nation on the whole, the Queen Mother and the King, there's three families that the leaders of those, the kings and queen mothers of the nation, are chosen. So they rotate it, basically. Now what happens is, if it's my family's turn, for example, and we don't have a qualified candidate, we don't have somebody that the Queen Mother is willing to put her reputation on the line for, if we don't have anybody who's followed the taboos, who's from childhood, they monitor these people from childhood to make sure they're a person of good character. If we don't have anyone who can represent our family as such, then they will move on to the next family, and they get an opportunity to put somebody there. So it's family held, but it's not that kind of combative thing. For what's going to be the Queen Mother in the movie would imply that they're talking about it from the perspective of a matrilineal perspective. But you never know.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a
system. Well, let me ask you this about the Asante today. Just even in Ghana, obviously, you know, once upon a time, maybe, you know, at least a century or more ago, I'm sure, well, we'll say even before the colonizers came in and, you know, took everything, you know, vanquished and defeated, well, not defeated, but, you know, as you stated, you know, took control over the land and the gold and, you know, everything. I'm sure that to be and to have the power of the stool and just even the political power to be a part of the council, you know, the priesthood, all of that that goes along with, you know, being connected with the stool and the king and the queen mother. Coming forward, fast forwarding centuries now up until today, is the same, I guess, is the stool viewed the same as back then? I mean, because, again, since then, you know, colonizers have come and go. The Asante political system that was in place, you know, prior to the colonizers coming, I'm sure, and I don't know what if they're practicing a democracy over there now. I guess my question is, does the divine kingship carry the same power amongst, or not power, but reverence amongst the people as it did based on your research from centuries ago?
The answer to that question would be yes and no. Within the family, the practitioners of the system, it still carries a lot of reverence and importance. As a matter of fact, there's a part of the research I did, I interviewed several people, several of whom, actually, Yasante was the second of one of them. Mm-hmm. Actually was working, she was called home to be the queen mother from here. She was living in New Jersey. She was working at that career here in New Jersey. And when the family called her and said, we need you to come home and be the queen mother. Now, I understand she's given up a good, quote-unquote, job here. She's given up comfort and creature comforts and those kind of things here. Moves home into a situation where she now is going to be, quote-unquote, challenged materially and economically, but because of the importance of the stool to the family, they're willing to make those sacrifices. And I know several people who've done just that. There were people who were living abroad who, when the time came up, they gave up what they had to go home and do it. I also know some people who refused to do it because they got too wrapped up in what they're here. So, you know, it goes both ways, cuts both ways. But within Ghana itself, though, still have great reverence for the most part, for the traditional rulers. The problem is that the political governments, the Western political systems, the parliamentary systems, have been stripping the traditional rulers of their power and influence over the years, so much so that in the major cities, you would hardly know that there's a traditional system in place. All you see is the Western model of governance and the same creature things that go on there.
When you look at the young people over there, and I know, I don't know how many of the people that you interviewed over there were of the younger generation, do you see hope for the continuance of the Asante divine kingship even in the youth? I mean, because you mentioned the influence of the West on, you know, Ghana, not just Ghana, we just say the world now. And a lot of younger people, you know, aren't carrying the mantle of the ancestors. You know, they aren't into that. You know, that's the old folks stuff. You know, that's old time, you know. But when you did your research and you went there, when you looked at the younger people, the teenagers in early 20s or maybe even in the 30s, did they hold did most of them seem caught up in the West, or did you see hope that there was at least a group or even a minority of people over there that seemed to be wanting to hold on, took pride in, and wanted to, you know, see the continuance of their culture survive?
Well, Well, the answer to that question is yes and no, too.
Okay.
Yeah, there are youth, young people there who are fighting hard to recapture, reclaim, hold on to tradition and practices, et cetera. There's also young people there who don't give anything, don't care much about it. They just want to be engaged in the West, whatever the cost may be. Well, so again, it's promoted as the, they believe both tradition, most people in Africa unfortunately believe that if you live in America, you're living wealthy. That you ain't having to work hard, you ain't having to struggle, you ain't have to do all this, the streets are paved with gold. All those myths still are largely prominent in the minds of most people. So much so that when people, well, but that's a side move there. But relative to the impact and the influence of the West on people and the infatuation with it, one of the things where you see it, especially in Ghana, one of the things that you see a big challenge in terms of holding on to tradition and culture is in dress.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone except the practitioners of the culture primarily is in Western dress all the time. I mean, they have a thing in the government, they call it traditional Fridays, where you wear African clothes on Fridays. But still, you know, that doesn't happen. Like, for example, Benin, the official religion in Benin is Vodou. When you go to Benin, even though there are Muslims there, they're Christians there, whatever, there are a large number of people wear traditional cloth in Benin. So they're holding on to that of the culture. Because the spirituality is the root, the foundation of African culture, Christ is kept. And once you give up your spiritual context, then you begin to lose hold on who you are as a people and your connection to the ancestral tradition. That's what's happening in Ghana. If you go into Ghana today, unfortunately, you will believe that if you didn't know you were in Africa, you might, in Accra especially, you might believe you were in some European city. Because the darkness of the people, you just look at the structure. Because you'll see billboards for evangelists, this, evangelist, that, coming over and doing these faith nights and all this stuff. I mean, you would be hard-pressed to believe that there's something called African traditional religion there. But back to the COVID thing, to show you how if it comes from the West, it's good. I went to the ceremony. This brother was had been in stool. He had a position in stool. I went to the ceremony.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part. You were kind of muffled.
No, I went to the ceremony. This brother had gotten in stool. And so I went to a ceremony. His friend of mine, he was a cousin of a friend of mine. So I went to the ceremony. It was outside the palace where the installment took place. There was a guy, a young guy, must have been like 17, 18, I don't know, 15, I don't know, walking down the street, he had a shirt on. The shirt come from the West. He's a male. And the shirt says, "I am a proud lesbian." So I stopped the guy. I said, "You know what the church says?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "You know what a lesbian is?" The boy had no clue. All he knew was that the church came from America.
Said, "I am a proud lesbian." Wow. Did he take it off once you told him?
No, he kept walking.
Wow. That really speaks to the destruction of your culture and how ultimately you've been taught to either overtly or covertly, just directly or indirectly, to hate who you are, you know,
exactly.
Just to hate, you know, to really hate who you are to the point that, you know, it just, as you don't even want to wear your own clothes, you know. That reminds me of a young lady that I met who was about 17 years old, and we were having a good discussion, and she was in Western dress, and I asked her, did she ever wear her traditional dress? I forget what country she was from, might have been Angola or somewhere. And she said, no, she didn't. She said, only when she goes to church. on Sundays, but the reason she didn't wear them to school was because she said that the other children would laugh at her. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's a woman, young woman from Africa, you know, and I'm sure the traditional dress was probably, you know, nice and colorful and, you know, that, but she said that the other kids would laugh at her, you know. And what it sounds like to me, that same self-hatred that those children were having is experienced amongst the people in Africa, in certain parts of Africa as well. And that's very, very, very disheartening. But how do you think that when you see somebody like that, that you could reach them and that even hearing of the glory? Because many people who grow up over there, I'm sure, are so many centuries removed from when traditional African religion was practiced by everybody, you know, in the society, you know, that you have generations of people that might say, oh, that was old stuff. The grandmama might say, that's how long it's been, right? The grandmama might say, that was a long time ago. So you know then the father and the mother would say that was a long time ago. So even coming down to the young man who you saw with the I'm a Proud Lesbian shirt on, he might have truly felt like if you had tried to share information with him concerning the Asante and who he really was, who he is, it might have really fallen on deaf ears. Your thoughts?
Well, it's possible. But before we go off on another question, let me just put this point out there, too, in terms of the clothing thing. Because, you know, the clothing that people donate to Salvation Army and Goodwill, et cetera, that you expect is going to be going to poor people here in the U.S., people who need clothes. But the clothes are actually sold abroad. There's a huge market. They've destroyed the traditional clothing industries by forcing all these used Western clothes into the market. As a matter of fact, a country, I think it might have been Ghana, some country, I forget which country it was going to stop the import of Western clothes, used clothing, and they were threatened with sanctions from Western powers. So these are different ways that the West destroys the culture of the people by forcing them out of their clothes because it's expensive now to buy traditional cloth in Ghana in terms of most people can't afford it. So it's very cheap. You'll get these used Western clothes that somebody you thought was poor, and they're selling them in Africa.
That's deep. That's deep. I mean, to the point, see, we're getting an education. I really appreciate this conversation. And again, to everybody online, if you're listening, you want to ask a question or jump in the conversation, all you have to do is just press 1. But to think that now, here you have countries who are supposed to be sovereign in their own right? You know, they're supposed to be sovereign in their own right. And to be forced to say that even you're going to take these clothes, you know what I'm saying? You're going to even take these clothes, we're still going to control you. We're still going to control, in 2018, we're still going to control what you wear. You know, what you wear. We're still even, Dad, you already are giving your children our names. I mean, you're giving your children our names. But now, we're going to even force you to continue to wear our clothes? Wow, that was a doozy right there, my brother. That was a doozy.
Yeah,
wow. I was reading your book. I was reading your book again. Oh, are you okay, Orwa? You still good?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. I was reading your book, and there was a condition or a ritual called ritual regicide. Is that how it's pronounced? R-E-G-I-C-I-D-E, ritual regicide. And could you share what that is, because it was intriguing. It was intriguing to me. It was dealing with the national calamities if a ruler or a king, because the king was endowed with, according to the people, they figured that since he was a divine king, a god a God king, that he had all power, and that if, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, if there were certain natural disasters like tornadoes or hurricanes or something, that could be viewed as though, and it destroyed all of the crops of the people or whatever, then that could be viewed as though the king was losing his power.
Or that it's time for him to move on, one way or the other. Well, that, yeah, that was a practice in some places, in some cultures, where, you know, once a person became unable to physically continue to provide the strength and guidance for the culture, then they would willingly sacrifice their life to move on. Because you understand that we're eternal beings. So it's not about losing our life. It's about saving the community and the culture. But give me a few moments to transition.
Yes, sir. Okay, everybody, my special guest is Orwa Hehi Medoran Comet. He's going to be right back with us. Hope everybody's enjoying the conversation. Again, if you have a question or comment where you want to talk to me while we're waiting on Orwa to come back, that's fine. All you have to do is just press 1 on your phone, and it will let me know, and I'll bring you on, and we can talk for a while. My special guest again is Orwa, Dr. Orwa Hehi Medoran Comet. He is Paramount King of the Washington, D.C. region of the Osara Set Society. We're talking about reality versus fiction, the divine African kingship in review. Everybody, if you just were born yesterday, you know that there's been a movie out called Black Panther that has been making a lot of news. I mean, it's been breaking all kinds of records and, you know, everything. And interesting movie. I went and saw it. And Orwa and I have been discussing parts of the movie today. And very interesting. And we've been making some very interesting correlations between what's real about the movie and what's fiction about the movie. So, again, everybody, just be patient. Orwa is going to be right back with us. Just in case you haven't gotten his book, let me tell you about it. It's called Divine Kingship of Asante. We're going to be telling you about a workshop that's coming up on this Saturday. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you about it now while we're waiting for him. On this Saturday, there's going to be a workshop in Washington, D.C. It's called The Divine Kingship of Asante, a Model for Sustainable Development of Self and Community. That's going to be this Saturday on March the 10th, starting at 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. That's going to be at the Thurgood Marshall Center at 1816 12th Street in Northwest Washington, D.C. Again, that's 1816 12th Street in Washington, Northwest Washington, D.C. And to register for that, you want to go to www.appeal, that's A-P-P like Paul, E-A-L, Inc., that's Incorporated, .org. Again, that's www.appeal.org. For more information, please call either 202-630-2507 or 1-800-711-7851. Again, those numbers are 202-630-2507 or 800-711-7851, and it's going to be free to all first-time workshop attendees and free to appeal members as well, but it will be $10 for all others, okay? Looks like Orwa is back with us. Orwa, if you don't mind, there you are. If you don't mind pressing 1, Orwa, then that'll push you up to the top, and then I can bring you on board, okay? Brother Orwa? Okay. There we are. Thank you so much, my brother. Brother Orwa, is that you, 5-5?
Yes, it's me.
Okay. Welcome back. Okay. Brother Orwa, I was telling him about the workshop that taking place on this Saturday. We got a little time left. Can you talk about the workshop and how that's going to even to help spread the word about this? I've been telling people about your book, too, The Divine Kingship of Asante, your thesis, and how just even people getting that book and how important this information is. Even as I read the book and I'm reading it again, I'm really seeing a lot of hard work, a lot of research went into that. Could you talk about even the why a book such as this is important and why a workshop such as this is important on Saturday?
Well, I can answer that in one question. One answer, rather. 45.
Okay. 45.
Mm-hmm. He's the successor of 44.
I'm sorry?
He's the successor of 44.
45 is the successor of 44.
Yes. Somebody in your audience got the joke.
Okay.
45 is your current president. Is your current president.
Uh-huh.
So that's why this is important. Because that's where this is the best that Western culture has to offer.
I got you. I got you. I got it. Got it. You know what? I was thinking about that, and that reminded me when I came across, when I was reading your book, and I came across The Divine Right of Kings, I said to myself, sounds like what's currently going on in the country right now.
Mm. Yeah, that's what your boy wants to establish.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Republican Party is trying to promote. That, you know, let's look at this. This stuff is so corrupt, it's phenomenal, which is why we need to look at our own traditional practices and systems. But let's just look at this from this perspective. Now, when you do polling, even amongst people of Congress, right, 70-some, I think it's like 70-some percent or more of Congress says that they want to do something to deal with this Dreamer situation, right? Now, Congress passes laws. The president has an option to either sign the law or veto the law. If the president vetoes the laws, then all Congress needs is 66%, two-thirds majority, to override a presidential veto. So if more than 70%, it's more than 70% of Congress wants to do something with an issue, any issue, all they have to do is pass a law. They have enough votes to override the president. But they're so embedded, the corruption is so embedded with one another that, for example, Mitch McConnell says, we're waiting on leadership from the president. That's not his job. His job as the head of the legislature is to usher through bills that need to address the needs of the community, of the people. But they're so embedded with one another in terms of the corruption that they won't do anything to help the people because they're trying to figure out how they're going to get paid out of the process. And that's why we got to look at our own traditional systems. That's why it's important that we study our divine kingship systems, because our ancestors have been practicing this political system for more than 5,000 years. This democracy thing is a baby. It's an infant. It's falling apart, really. It's only like 200 years old at best. And it ain't even that yet, because when you start measuring when the democracy get to America, you gotta question when it's going to get to America. Because you got the situation where when they started the country, only white men would have property could vote. Then later on, white men could vote who didn't have property. Then later on, black people were given a right and then taken the back a right from voting because they didn't have property. And then later on, white women were given the right to vote. And then later on, black people were given another right to vote again, but it's been taken back through gerrymandering, et cetera. So the question is, when did America ever establish a democracy? The answer to that question is that it hasn't yet. But the reason it hasn't is because of the corruption of the system in place. It's about serving the interests of the wealthy. We all know that 1% of the population controls, what, 90% of the wealth or something like that? It's corrupt to the core. And they will talk about corruption in Africa. And I'm not saying there ain't corruption in Africa, but what I will say is that the leaders of Africa who are corrupt learn it from the best.
Well, let's talk for a moment then even about the role in the divine African kingship, the role that priests play, okay? Because, you know, you mentioned one of the congressional people and how, you know, it would be easy for laws just to get passed if the people in Congress would do their job. But even when it comes down to the president and this person, and this country having the last word in most cases, or in many cases, or the king having the last word, it's important that the counsel that you receive is good, okay? That the information that you receive from the people on your council that sit, you know, at the table of political power with you are righteous and, you know, God-men themselves, so that the information that you have to draw on when it comes to making a decision is based on truth, you know, wisdom. So could you talk about the role of the priests in the African traditional, divine traditional African kingship?
Okay, well, there's some very good points to be made from that perspective relative to the Asante. So since we're talking about that, let's just look at that perspective. The Asante Nation came into existence because of the spiritual work of a priest. His name was Akonfo Anoche. He's the one who caused the golden stool to descend from the heavens and land on the lap of Osei Tutu I, who became the first king. Because up to that point, the Asante Nation was getting their butts kicked by another kingdom called Denchira. Because the Asante people were like seven different isolated autonomous communities. Each had their own rulers, each had their own land, etc. But they weren't they had no unifying force or feature. So they would be all subjugated by this one king. So once the golden stool came down and the rituals that Akonfo Anoche had them perform to cement the union, then the Asante Nation became strong and was able to overthrow the Denchira king and grow and expand. That's one point. Osei Tutu and Akonfo Anoche was a major priest in the Asante literature. He's the foundation of the literature. He performed a number of miracles, but he also gave good counsel. The king, a good king, will follow the counsel of his spiritual leaders, for example. And there's a good precedent for that in Asante. The first king, Osei Tutu I, ended up getting killed because he didn't follow the counsel of Akonfo Anoche. He was told not to cross this river called Pra at a certain time, right? But he did, and he ended up getting killed. So now, whenever the king sits in state, the Asante king, he's reminded by those around him of all the things that he's done over the course of time, and one of the things would be by not following the priest, how it led to his demise. So, you know, in interviewing the kings I interviewed, you know, one of the Koko Fuhini mentioned, he said something very poignant, where he said that, sure, the king can, he has the right to ignore any counsel he gets from anyone. The queen mother can counsel him, he can ignore that, etc. But what Koko Fuhini said was, if he's wise, he won't ignore the spiritual practices, the spiritual teachings, the spiritual counsel. Because, you know, even though the king is by his right of his position, he's the head of all the shrines, he's the head of the religion. He is not trained. His training is limited in that area. So it's wise for him to follow the counsel that he gets from those who have been dedicated their lives to cultivating that spiritual wisdom and knowledge and practices.
Well, just out of curiosity, how would a priest be chosen? I mean, we talk about how the king would be chosen. Just out of curiosity, I'm sure that might be asking a question somebody out there wants to know too. Then, how are the people that are giving him counsel, or in the case of Queen Mother, if she's sitting on the stool, how are the priests chosen?
Well, it's different ways. Some are through linear ancestral training, linear training, where they, you know, their father or whomever was a priest, and so they're trained to assume those traditions and practices. That takes place. There are also people who are called to the stool by the shrine, by the Obusum, or the gods, so-called gods. I know a number of people who, like, you know, just this young priestess, one of the people I interviewed, she was just a young girl, like 8, 17, 15, something like that, just going to school. And all of a sudden, one day, it hit her. The spirit hit her. And she's the priest today. You know, your degree is going to come from something else. Forget this algebra and math. You got to go and do some spiritual calculus.
Wow. Well, could you talk about the saying, and I hope I'm saying it right, Onyame Nehene, God is the king. Am I saying that correctly? Onyame Nehene, God is the king. That to me struck home, because if in the Asante culture, if that was the premise, you know, that most people understood as, okay, yeah, we might have a king, but God is the king, you know. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they were saying that the king is God, you know what I mean? And that those two phrases or those two ways of looking at it were interchangeable. Would that be safe to say that if the king was God's viceroy in the earth realm, then it could be said both ways, the king is God and God is king?
Well, within traditional Africa, and going back as far as our written history, back to ancient Kemet, the goal of each person was to become a divine being. And the man or woman who sat on the stool or the throne was no different from anyone else in terms of that goal. It's just that they became now the representative of the supreme being to the masses of the community. So, but everyone was seeking to awaken their divinity. So the point that the position that the proverb that you say is just that. It reminds the king that he is there to serve the supreme being, and reminds everyone else that the king is an emissary, he's a viceroy for God himself. And so he's not above and beyond the supreme beings, which is different from the European model, right? In the European model, once the quote, the divine right of kings, then the man is himself is viewed as God's personage, and that's it. And nothing you can say or do about that. But in this situation, no, you're sitting on the stool, but God is king, so we can put somebody else on the stool.
You can be taken off, right? What about, and I know we only got a few minutes left, Orwa, and I thank you so much for your time. I noticed there was a splitting of hairs over, you know, the terms divine kingship versus the sacred kingship. Where did that come from? I mean, because they seem to be saying the same thing to me.
Well, that's Western scholars, you know, trying to pontificate what they do. This is what they do. They make up stuff. They make up terms. They make up concepts. They get people to buy into the terms and concepts, and then they promote it. I mean, because at one time, you know, the whole thing about psych and psychology and psychiatry, et cetera, well, psych is a Greek term, and it didn't even mean mind as it's used. It's like psych now refers to the mind. Psychiatry is a mind who's got issues, psychology, et cetera. Well, in the Greek language, the term psych was actually the term that meant spirit. But when the age of enlightenment, so-called age of enlightenment came, and these scholars were now trying to wrestle the power and influence away from the priest and the church, then they had to come up with their own lexicon. So then psych became a secular term, so-called, as opposed to talking about spirit. So, preacher man, you can talk about spirit, but when you talk about the mind, psych, we're not talking about the same thing. We're talking about something else different, even though the term means the same thing. So they just create terms. They just talk. They just make up stuff to hear themselves think sometimes.
You know, there also seem to be a correlation, not a correlation, but a strong significance, as I was reading your book, to the number 7, even as it relates to, you know, just spirituality. There just seems to be some great significance to the number 7. I was reading, there was an excerpt from the priest named Mandalanga. He had a discourse with Bowen, And he was saying that man is on a journey, the goal of which is union with the source of his being, the Itongo, the supreme being. To reach that goal, he is born and born again. There are seven levels through which an individual must evolve through many lifetimes. One was the pupil, two was the disciple, three was the brother, four was the elder, five was the master, six was those who know, and seven, he says, we call them, I don't know how to pronounce that, Abakulunta or something, which is the supreme ones or perfect men. And I just thought, I was reminded when I read that, I thought immediately of the seven divisions of the spirit. And, you know, there are references. Would that be a good correlation?
Oh, yeah, because that guy was a member of, you remember in the quotes, he talked about how his teachings come from ancient Egypt, his so-called temple of Khufu, he tells Cheops, it's so-called, but Khufu we know it to be. So, you know, and he said that there's at least one of his members of his brotherhood in every nation in Africa. So this, the spiritual union of concepts and culture is practiced. You know, there's a concept called cultural unification of culture. It's the idea that there's a commonality of cultural influences through the continent. And it is, but it's just that it becomes displayed and practiced in different ways in different cultures, but the same principles exist, which is why I was able to make that connection between the principle of the supreme, the man being a divine being in Kemet, and with the same thing being practiced and known in Asante. Unfortunately, though, so few people today are practicing those traditions in Asante, and so few are practicing the traditions of Kemet. That's why, again, taking us back to the source, the original question, why this workshop and our study in this area is so important. Because our ancestors, let me just leave you with this point. What time is it? It's about that time, right?
It's 8:03. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to just leave at this point. Let me go back to the movie. After after the movie ended, you know, the second ending of the movie, did you stay and watch that?
I just saw one ending. I didn't know there was a second one.
Oh, man, you missed the best part. I mean, well, there's a lot of good parts, but you missed a very good part. In the second ending, you got to stay through the credits, because after credits run, there's another ending.
Oh.
And after credits run, there's another ending. A lot of people missed it because, you know, people are so fast to get up out of there. But anyway, there's a question.
Right.
There's a question that was asked in the second ending. The king was speaking to the UN, I guess it was, and he was talking about how Wakanda had been holding back from sharing its gifts with the world, et cetera. And so this white guy, sitting, one of the members of from some country, whatever, I don't know, he raised his hand and asked, he said, "Pardon me, sir, not being disrespectful or anything, but what kind of community of farmers teach the world?" That's the answer that I'm going to give this Saturday. What a community of farmers can give to the world.
Interesting. Everybody, make sure that you're there. That's the Divine Kingship of Asante, a model for a sustainable development of self and community. When? That's Saturday. This Saturday, March the 10th. What time? 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Where? The Thurgood Marshall Center, and that's at 1816 12th Street in Northwest Washington, D.C. You can register online at www.appeal, that's APPEALINC, that's incorporated, .org. And if you'd like more information, go to, or call, shall I say, 202-630-2507. Again, that's 202-630-2507. Or you can call 1-800-711-7851. Again, that's 800-711-7851. For all of the first-time workshop attendees, This is absolutely free for you, as well as to all of the appeal members. It's absolutely free for you. For everybody else, it's only $10, okay? And again, I say only because I always joke and say you can find $10 and change in your cushions of your couch, okay? So that's how affordable it is. So you don't have any reason not to be there if you're in the Washington, D.C. area. Again, that's the Divine Kingship of Asante, a model for sustainable development of self and community. That's Saturday, March the 10th from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Thurgood Marshall Center at 1816 12th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. Register online at www.appealinc.org. And for more information, call 202-630-2507. Oh, if I can squeeze in one last question before we go, okay, because I know that there are a lot of people that have misconceptions about all of this, and you can't have a discussion about traditional African religion and not talk about African veneration. Some call it African ancestor worship. Did I say African veneration? Ancestor veneration. Some call it African, or shall I say, ancestor worship. There is a difference between ancestor worship and ancestor veneration. That's a very big part, very large part in traditional African religion. Can you clarify that for some people?
Not in a short span of time I have. But I'm doing another presentation at the end of March the 24th dealing with evidence-based spirituality is the title of the presentation. And we'll deal with that on that particular concept. That concept is part of that time. So it's going to be March the 24th at our place, and we'll come back on and talk about that later.
Okay. We're going to definitely have you back on to discuss evidence-based spirituality.
Yeah. Now, I know this is going to be a problem for those who are into the government, because Trump administration has outlawed the use of the words evidence-based. But, you know, we'll move on.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Evidence-based?
Yeah, you didn't read that? Yeah, they told the EPA or some scientific group that, you know, because people always talk about evidence-based science and this, they said do not use that term. They told the administrators and that thing. Yeah, because they want fake news. They don't want no evidence-based nothing. Gotta go. Okay, man. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everybody. That's Oahehe, Dr. Oahehe Medoran Comet, King of the Washington, D.C. region of the Osiriset Society. Where y'all going to be on Saturday, March the 10th, if you're in the D.C. area? I know where you're going to be. You're going to be at the Thurgood Marshall Center, because there's going to be an awesome workshop there, The Divine Kingship of Asante, a model for sustainable development of self and community. I have really, really, truly enjoyed this interview today. Every time I have an opportunity to speak with Dr. Nkomet, I learn so much, and I know that you all do too. Just so that you know, if you're listening online, if you didn't know, we have an archives. And if you want to hear more of Dr. Nkomet, all you have to do is just scroll down the archives. We've done shows with him on the 11 Laws of God. We've done shows with him on the 7 Divisions of the Spirit. We've done shows with him on the I Ching, show called God Knows Best. We've done all kinds of shows with Dr. Nkomet. Just scroll down the archives. We've also got shows with Shechem Meshechem, Dr. Rahun Nefer Amen, in the archives as well. As a matter of fact, one of the shows that I'm promoting for this month for everybody to listen to is Stress Free for Life by Dr. Rahun Nefer Amen. That show is also in the archives, as well as Understanding the Spring Equinox with Hexham Suheru, Shechem Me'ab Neter. That's in the archives as well, okay? So why wait until the spring equinox is here and you're not prepared for it, or you don't understand what it's all about, so that you can be up to speed and you understand the observance and why you're observing it? Then just scroll down the archives until you find that show. It's called Understanding the Spring Equinox. That is with Hexham Suheru, Shechem Me'ab Neter. We've also got shows with Dr. Ted Watkins. He's going to be coming on this Saturday, as a matter of fact, from 8 to 9 a.m., so I don't want you to miss that. I've got shows with Brother Coy Dunson cured his mother of cancer in both breast, the liver, and the colon. Dr. Ruby Lathan cured herself of thyroid cancer. These shows are all in the archives. Okay, so I invite you to just scroll down the archives so you see a show that you like. All you have to do is just click it and listen and grow. Who am I? My name is Juwanza. Thank you so much for tuning in. I certainly appreciate you. As I always say, I don't take you for granted. You could be doing anything, but you're listening, and I'm so glad that you're here. Again, who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? That's it.